Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 3rd of October, these are our main stories. The EU considers Britain's new Brexit deal as the Prime Minister tries to convince MPs that he's found a way forward. But is he right? A curfew has been imposed in Baghdad after violence between police and protesters who are angry at corruption and unemployment. Also,
people remember that when we lived under a dictatorship, things were wrong.
Will memories of the past shape this weekend's election in Portugal? Also in this podcast, the leaders of Nigeria and South Africa meet in Johannesburg. On the agenda, violence against Nigerians there. And
we want to just focus on, right, the beauty of the landscape. We're still kind of removing, you know, a big chunk of that history. And I think to do that is really a slap in the face to people of color in this country.
Should tourists to the American South be taught more about the brutal legacy of slavery? We begin here in Britain, and with just a few weeks to go before the country leaves the European Union, the Prime Minister has been addressing Parliament, outlining the details of his new Brexit deal. Boris Johnson insisted he's made a genuine attempt to compromise and strike a deal.
I do not for one moment resile from the fact that we have shown great flexibility in the interests of reaching an accommodation with our European friends and achieving the resolution for which we all yearn. If our European neighbours choose not to show a corresponding willingness to reach a deal, then we shall have to leave on October the 31st without an agreement.
But the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, said Mr Johnson's plans weren't good enough.
Deal or no deal, Mr Speaker, this government's agenda is clear. They want a Trump deal Brexit. A Trump deal Brexit that would crash our economy and rip away the standards that put a floor under people's rights at work, that protect our environment and protect our consumers. No Labour MP could support such a reckless deal that would be used as a springboard to attack rights and standards in this country.
I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson to sum up the key statements made today in Westminster.
All of the opposition parties spoke out against Mr Johnson's deal, so he's really going to struggle there. But I think he might take some encouragement because some Conservative MPs who were expelled from the party for supporting that law outlawing a no-deal Brexit, I mean, most of them that did speak spoke encouragingly about his efforts to get a deal. He also, of course, Mr Johnson, got support from the right of the Conservative Party, the people who were so difficult, who were such a thorn in the side of Theresa May, the pro-Brexiteers. They spoke in favour. But look, I don't think there's any doubt that in terms of domestic British politics, you know, he's going to have an uphill struggle.
Do you think he will get the support he needs, or is just the opposition objections too much?
I think it would be incredibly close. I mean, again, you know, in many ways, I think the answer to your question, and it's the same question for the Europeans, for everybody really, it's what you think is worse. I mean, do you think Mr. Johnson's deal is kind of worse, or do you think that leaving the European Union without a deal is worse, or do you think that an extension to the Brexit process and more uncertainty is worse? So I think British politicians, just for folk in Europe as well, I think they'll just be choosing a series of what they think of as the least worst option, not the best. How it would work out if a deal comes back and is put to a vote in Parliament, I simply couldn't say. I suspect it would be very close.
Because we're meant to be leaving at the end of this month. Surely there's not that much time when they've got to make a decision.
No, and to some extent that, of course, does help Boris Johnson, certainly in terms of his own governing Conservative Party, where all sorts of Conservatives who voted Remain in the referendum think Brexit is utterly daft. They don't like the look of this deal very much. But they are traumatised by what the whole Brexit uncertainty has done to the governing Conservative Party, what it's done to the government and what it's done to the country. So Mr. Johnson may be hoping that he gets those people back on side and that perhaps some opposition MPs from the Labour Party who represent constituencies which voted heavily for Leave, maybe he could get them on his side. But I mean, look, absolutely nobody knows the answer to your question, including, I rather fancy, Mr. Johnson.
That was Rob Watson, our political correspondent. As we record this podcast, the European Parliament's Brexit Committee is due to publish a detailed response to Boris Johnson's attempt to break the deadlock over Britain's departure from the EU. But at a news conference in Brussels, a spokeswoman for the European Commission, Natasha Berthaud, said the Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, believed the British proposals needed further work.
President Juncker welcomed the positive advances in the United Kingdom's text, but he also noted that there are problematic points in the proposal on which further work is needed by the UK. President Juncker stressed that the withdrawal agreement must have a legally operational solution, not arrangements that are to be developed and agreed in the transition period afterwards, and that this solution must meet all the objectives of the backstop, which are preventing a hard border, preserving North-South cooperation and the all-island economy, and protecting the EU's single market and Ireland's place within it.
Our Brussels correspondent Adam Fleming explained the main sticking points.
The problems fall into three categories. The first one is that this is not an operational proposal. It would not be ready to go. There's still lots of gaps and lots of questions that have to be answered and details that have to be provided. That's one of the EU's red lines, is that there is a legally operable thing that can go into the Brexit treaty. Second of all, the EU wants to protect what it calls the all-island economy. The fact that there were really tight, close economic business and personal links between Northern Ireland and Ireland. The EU's view is that this British proposal would disrupt those links and, in the words of one EU official to me last night, destroy them. That's another EU red line crossed by these proposals. Then there's the idea of giving the Northern Ireland Assembly and Executive effectively a veto over whether these arrangements ever come into play in the first place, and then whether they're renewed every 4 years. The EU is unsure about giving that much power to a government that is not the national government of the UK, and also to allow that level of uncertainty to be injected into the whole process, effectively, potentially, forever. So those, I think, are the big areas where the EU will be probing the UK over the next coming days, because there are going to be more talks. The EU has not rejected this outright. They've left the door open for the UK to come and explain in more detail what it's trying to achieve.
Adam Fleming, our Brussels correspondent. Reports from Iraq say at least 18 people have died in anti-government protests. The Iraqi Prime Minister has now imposed a complete curfew in Baghdad following the second day of demonstrations against unemployment, poor public services and rampant corruption. Dan Damon found out more from Simona Fulton, a freelance journalist based in Baghdad.
The city has been very quiet this morning after Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi imposed a curfew starting 5 a.m. this morning. People are still allowed to move around in their neighborhoods, for example, to go shopping, but all of the major thoroughfares and bridges have been closed, which means that there is very little traffic. And the internet also remains shut down, which means that protesters cannot organize as easily. And it's also very difficult to get an idea about the latest protests, especially the ones that happened last night. It's unknown, you know, what were the numbers of people that participated and whether there were any additional casualties.
The protests have been largely spontaneous, or would you say they have been organized?
All of the demonstrators I have spoken to so far have said that these protests are a grassroots movement comprised of a variety of people, men, women, graduates, the unemployed, the elderly, who are all airing their grievances that have accumulated over the past years. They have all denied the involvement of any political party, and they are, in fact, extremely disenfranchised and disappointed with the political establishment here. And many were, in fact, first-time demonstrators who have told us that they are demonstrating demonstrating because there is no political party involved.
And what are the conditions then that have driven people to get out onto the streets?
Well, they've really rattled off a laundry list of complaints. It begins with the lack of jobs. There is pretty large youth unemployment in the country, and it's very difficult for young graduates to get a job. Then there are also complaints about the lack of services. On the grander scheme of things, people have also complained about the government, the way it has been formed, and what they call foreign interference in internal affairs. There have been slogans that have been shouted, "Out with Iran, Baghdad will stand alone," which is quite a brave thing to say in opposition to Iraq's neighbor. And then, very surprisingly, actually, there has been quite a lot of criticism of the religious establishment. There have been people who have said that we are tired of the Islamist clerics being involved in politics in Iraq. They have destroyed the country, and there are a myriad of grievances, but all of the people that are protesting, they seem to be united in one thing, and that's simply that they want a better life, they want services, they want jobs, and they want their living standards to go up.
Simona Fulton, a freelance journalist who's based in Baghdad, speaking to Dan Damon. Police in India are investigating the theft of some of the ashes of the pro-independence leader Mahatma Gandhi. News of the theft came as India marked the 150th anniversary of Gandhi's birth. Jill McGivering reports.
After Gandhi's cremation more than 70 years ago, his ashes were divided and distributed across India. The thieves in Madhya Pradesh stole a brass urn containing his remains and also defiled a poster of Gandhi at the same exhibit by daubing it with the word anti-national. As Wednesday's tribute suggested, most Indians revere Gandhi, who is known as the father of the nation. But some Hindu extremists praise his murderer and accuse Gandhi of betraying Hindus by, in their view, appeasing Muslims.
That was Jill McGivering, our South Asia editor. This Sunday, Portugal will hold a general election. For the last 4 years, the socialists have governed with the support of other leftist parties. Portugal's economy is enjoying relative stability, and Prime Minister António Costa appears to be on course for victory. But the success of Portugal's centre-left is not the only thing that makes the country unusual compared to its neighbours, as Guy Hedgecoe reports.
Prime Minister António Costa addresses supporters at a socialist rally in Santarém, north of Lisbon. His party has been leading polls, and the main uncertainty going into this election is whether or not the socialists will secure a parliamentary majority and be able to govern alone. António Costa has ended his campaign rally with a rendition of the national anthem. And the success of the socialists here seems to contrast very much with the problems that centre-left parties have been having elsewhere in Europe. But there's another thing that makes Portugal different to its European neighbours, and that's the fact that there's no far-right or populist party to speak of here in the political arena.
The ability of this government to govern successfully is, of course, related with the lack of success of the far-right. And the two of them are also tied to the fact that pro-European sentiment is on the rise in Portugal.
João Galamba is a socialist junior minister. Although the political opposition insists that Portugal's economic recovery remains fragile, he says its growth in the wake of the crisis of half a decade ago has reassured voters and restored their faith in the EU.
We've increased jobs significantly. We've increased the minimum wage. The average wage and wages in general are rising. We were able to do this while reducing the deficit and the debt. So we sort of managed something that many considered impossible. I think that is one of the reasons why we differentiate ourselves from other socialist parties in Europe.
One of Lisbon's famous yellow trams has just driven past me. And one of the measures introduced by this government has been to make public transport cheaper for all Portuguese. But the social and economic achievements of this government are certainly not the only reason why populism is having so little impact here. A driving force behind populism in other EU countries is opposition to immigration. But Portugal, which is geographically less accessible than Spain, Greece or Italy for migrants coming from Africa, has seen fewer arrivals than many of its neighbours. 2019 marks 45 years since the Carnation Revolution,
and the Portuguese peacefully ended four decades of fascist dictatorship to the soundtrack of the folk song Grandola Vila Morena. Pedro Felipe Soares is a member of parliament for the left bloc, which has supported Mr. Costa's government. He believes historical memory is playing a role in keeping the far right away from the mainstream.
The memories of the fascist time are not good memories for our people. And that memory still exists. There was people starving in Portugal. There was a big unemployment rate. So people remember that when we lived under a dictatorship, things were wrong.
Not everyone agrees that Portugal is historically inoculated against the hard right or immune to populism in general. But while many EU countries wrestle with instability and polarised, unpredictable politics, there is a consensus that right now, Portugal is different.
Guy Hedgeco with that report. Still to come in this podcast.
This rise in ready availability of cheap, energy-dense food that have long shelf lives and aren't hugely full of great nutrients and which are hugely and heavily marketed.
We look at the reasons behind a dramatic global rise in childhood obesity. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has called on the leader of South Africa to ensure violence against migrants and refugees is stamped out. Nigerian nationals and their businesses have been targeted in a recent wave of attacks in South African cities. President Buhari's visit to South Africa is the first by a Nigerian leader since 2013, with the aim of bolstering trade ties between the two African powerhouses. I got more details from our correspondent in Johannesburg, Milton.
This visit is very significant, but it's important to point out that it was arranged long before the xenophobic violence that we saw last month.
And the recent outbreak of this xenophobic violence, for our listeners, how bad was it? I know I saw a few videos and it looked pretty horrific, some of it.
Yes, indeed. It looked pretty bad. It was bad. A lot of shops were damaged. But the government announced that 12 people were killed, and of the 12, only two were foreigners, and none of those two were Nigerians. So there were two Zimbabweans. So in context, the reaction that came out of Nigeria, that Nigerians are being killed, seems to have been unfounded. But that's not to take away from those who were injured and the businesses that were torched in the violence.
And Nigeria and South Africa are great rivals. How will improved ties help each nation, especially when it comes to the economies?
That is the central part of this visit, is to strengthen the trade relationship between the countries. President Ramaphosa's office said that trade goes beyond the here and now. They are looking into social, economic, scientific and technical relations. This is also a 20-year anniversary of the Binational Commission, which is the formal structure within which Nigeria and South Africa conducts its own relationship.
That was Milton Nkosi speaking to me from Johannesburg. New research predicts that childhood obesity will soar over the next decade, overwhelming health services around the world. The study by the World Obesity Federation says the number of children classified as obese will rise to around 250 million by 2030, up from 150 million today. Katie Silver explained the findings.
What they've created is a childhood obesity atlas, and basically they've rated countries on their chances of meeting the World Health Organization's target to see no rise in childhood obesity from basically 2010 to 2025. And very, very few countries pass the test. So of those 250 million obese children, about a fifth are considered to have perhaps severe obesity where they're going to need medical help. Now, the worst predicted countries. So by 2030, in China, nearly 62 million children are predicted to be obese. We're expecting 27 million in India and 17 million in the US. And so while we're seeing sort of this rise in some of the more affluent countries, we're also seeing it in poor countries. The Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania and Vietnam are all expected to have about 2 to 2.5 million obese children each, Charlotte.
And what's causing this problem?
Well, one of the researchers said basically it's 21st century life. It's harder to get fruit and vegetables. There's less green space. Kids aren't walking to school. But also, the BBC spoke to Dr. Louise Barr. She's a professor of child and adolescent health at the University of Sydney. And she also worked with this federation. And she says it comes down in a large part to how food is marketed.
This rise in ready availability of cheap, energy-dense food that have long shelf lives and aren't hugely full of great nutrients and which are hugely and heavily marketed in comparison with many of what we would see as much more healthful foods, which have shorter shelf lives, are more expensive, and as a result, of course, are less heavily marketed.
And what can be done so we don't have generations of children with, you know, long-term serious health problems?
So the issue is that basically obese children become obese adults. And these researchers say that the health systems cannot cope with the likes of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, associated cancers. What they're calling for is more government intervention. They say that there's basically been a critical failure of governments to protect a child's rights to good health. And they're also calling for a crackdown on this marketing that's going on when it comes to junk food.
That was Katie Silver. Next to the city of Charleston in the US state of South Carolina, where there have been claims that tourists aren't learning enough about the historical reality of slavery. 40% of all the African slaves who were brought into the US arrived in this port, and many of the picturesque plantation homes where they worked have now become tourist attractions. But do visitors focus too much on the beauty of the city and not enough on the brutal treatment of the slaves who built its wealth? Ritu Prasad reports from Charleston.
To my face, people have said slavery was not that bad.
Olivia Williams gives tours at McLeod Plantation in Charleston, South Carolina.
Here at McLeod, we do things a little bit differently than they do at other plantations in Charleston because we do focus our perspective on the enslaved people.
She was one of the guides mentioned in negative online reviews that recently went viral. Some visitors complained that the tour focused too much on slavery.
So you may feel uncomfortable, you may feel upset, sad, or angry, and that's perfectly fine. If you'd like to walk away, I won't get offended.
No one walked off during our tour, but there were moments where you could hear people trying to reckon with the beauty of the grounds and the reality of slavery.
It took a lot of work to manage one of these plantations, even though it was done with slave labor. Anyway, it's bad. I hated that, but they could have never managed all this down here without slave labor, or some kind of labor.
While most on our tour had not expected it to be slave-focused, they did appreciate it, as it's a history rarely taught in schools.
It's what you expect. It's as terrible as you would imagine it is. But I feel like it's important to be exposed that way, too, though. You need to know the truth.
But not all plantations in Charleston put the stories of slavery at the forefront.
This is the dream of Henry Middleton, shall we say.
Middleton Place brands itself as home to America's oldest landscaped gardens. But it's also one of the city's oldest plantations. Middleton offers a slave-focused tour, but if visitors aren't looking for it, they could miss it.
These places have a historical legacy to them, very much so.
Director of Preservation and Interpretation Jeff Neal says they have plans to make the stories of slaves more obvious.
This was basically a place of labor and it's great suffering, but this was also a place of family. These lands today also have a modern use, shall we say.
It's still remarkably easy to romanticize plantations. Weddings at these sites remain popular, a practice not everyone agrees with.
We would never go to, say, the 9/11 memorial and host a big party or have a wedding there because it's a beautiful site and completely forget that this atrocious thing happened. And so I think it's the same with plantations and historical sites around the South.
Dr. Camila Martin is director of African American Studies at the College of Charleston.
If we want to just focus on, the beauty of the landscape, we're still kind of removing, a big chunk of that history. And I think to do that is really a slap in the face to people of color in this country.
It was only last year that the mayor of Charleston publicly apologized for the institution of slavery. So it's no surprise that at many plantations, it's still possible to avoid that history altogether. McLeod tour guide Olivia Williams again.
So you have to understand the past to understand the present, but most importantly, you have to understand slavery. And people, it's so long ago. It wasn't.
Ignoring such a large part of American history can have unintended consequences. In Charleston, the 2015 mass shooting at the Mother Emanuel Church was one. 2 months before a white supremacist killed 9 black worshipers, he took a tour of McLeod Plantation.
If you read what Dylann Roof wrote, what you read is a narrative that is the same narrative that has been told at places like this for 150 years. It's the same narrative that I was taught growing up in the South. As people walk away from here, I hope that they begin to understand that while that may be a romantic notion, it's not an accurate notion, and it doesn't serve us very well as we try to reconcile with one another, racially speaking.
Every American plantation has its own story to tell, and its own way to tell it. Not all think bringing slavery to the forefront is necessary. But for some, plantations have a particular responsibility to the truth, to challenge beliefs on race and America's past.
That was Ritu Prasad reporting from Charleston, South Carolina. A major art exhibition is underway in Brussels at the Beaux-Arts Museum, and it's called Incarnations, African Art as Philosophy. It features 150 works of African art from the personal collection of Sindika Dikolo. He's originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he told Bola Mazoro about his exhibition.
We feel that it's very important, especially at this turn of the century, for Africa to be able to project itself in the 21st century and therefore to have access to its own creativity, whether contemporary or historic. I've realized that actually a lot of Africans still suffer from a sort of a complex that's inherited from the colonial era, which is basically that we feel that our history has started the day, in my case, I'm from the Congo. I'm originally from the Congo Kingdom. The day in 1482, when a Portuguese explorer set eyes for the first time on a subject of the Congo Kingdom. And this is so destructive to our own narrative, the way we see ourselves, the way we look at the world. So I feel the role of this kind of exhibition is actually to, first of all, celebrate Africa's creativity and also give us an opportunity to reflect on our identity and what we bring in terms of added value and narrative about ourselves.
Let me play devil's advocate then and ask, but why then exhibit in Brussels, one of the countries I would think you would least be likely to, given the relationship between the DRC and Brussels, your former, you used to be a colony of Brussels. Why take it there? Why not do it in the heart of the African continent?
Well, precisely, because if you look at Brussels, and especially this Museum of Beaux-Arts, it's been really built with the money and the bloody money of the Congo. So it made a lot of sense, actually, to bring this dialogue, this debate to Belgium. And I was very happy and surprised by how open the Belgian public opinion and public in general was interested in and actually open to revisiting this painful part of our common history. So we've done it in Beaux-Arts, but the whole objective now is to bring it over to Africa. But because the scenography was very specific, I had a very specific idea about what I wanted. And basically, none of the walls have been used. We just use them to project videos. But all of the art is exhibited on some structures that I could describe as, you know, sort of jungle gyms. But they're all in the middle.
They're not flat surfaces.
Exactly.
Most of the things.
So the whole idea is like a parcours of initiation. And we've mixed contemporary African art with classical art, because very often I feel that classical art is regarded by ourselves as Africans as something barbaric or something unholy or something negative.
And what do you regard as classical art?
Well, it's what a lot of people, too many people, still call tribal art, which is basically pre-contact, which is African art that was found when colonial power arrived in Africa. And we know very little about this very important part of our history. And this is something that we want to celebrate in this show.
That was the art collector Sindika Dikolo speaking to Bola Mazoro. And before we go, let's hear about another World Service podcast.
I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of The Conversation podcast from the BBC World Service.
Oh boy, I'm overwhelmed with so much to say in such a short time.
Some recent favourites include an episode on female roadies, these two incredible women who've just been touring the world with musicians and had some incredible stories to tell.
This is a live show and sometimes things go wrong, and tonight something's gone wrong.
I also found the episode on women living with schizophrenia incredibly powerful.
She does
not believe that there's such a thing as a mental illness. She still thinks that perhaps it was a demonic possession that happened to me.
Another episode was about a woman who was standing up to street harassment.
I'm sick of it. It's in front of my house, it's in my street, it's near my train station, it's all the time.
And I've always had female flight attendants on my wish list, and we finally got to speak to two women who had spent a lot of time up there.
People just stormed the door because they had to get off the plane. They were so scared.
That's the conversation from the BBC World Service.
Can't put price tag on these emotions.
Search for The Conversation wherever you found this podcast.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and until next time, goodbye.